Quick. Webcomics Weekly, ladies and gentlemen, it's back. You heard it last week, you'll hear it next week, and now you're hearing it now. We're down one person today. Chris Straub is going to be visiting his folks in La La Land. I guess he'll be coming to see you, Dave.
Yeah, we might as well have him over here at the old Sheldon studio in the weeks to come.
Yeah.
Might as well, huh? You sound excited.
Listen to me. Oh, great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to having Chris in my studio. Wonderful.
We might as well.
So Chris is home packing tonight. So we are down one man, but we're up two because we have a pre-recorded interview with Brian Gordon and Chris Harding over from Hallmark, talking to us a little bit about how work for hire is not as evil as it might seem. So that's good. Right?
Nice.
Yeah, sounds neat.
Wow, we're excited all around tonight. Who is with me? Who is with me tonight that's so excited? It's Smiling
Who's
Dave
with
Kellett.
Me? Huh? Who's with me, guys? Come on.
Smiling Dave Kellett from SheldonComics.com.
Heyo,
and the dark and twisted Brad Wigwam, always carrying a Glock Geiger from evil-comic.com.
It works for me, and it'll work for you.
And I am your perpetually speaking host, Scott Kurtz, over at pvponline.com. Okay, so straight to it, mailbag.
Mailbag. First question of the week is from a name that I've never been able to pronounce in French. Marc Lefebvre. Brad, you do a lot of sports. Help me out. How do you pronounce that name? Lefebvre?
How do you spell it?
It's like Favre, but it's Lefebvre. Is it so I just pronounce it Lefebvre? Marc Lefebvre?
I think you could call it Marc Lefebvre.
Marc Lefebvre?
Just pronounce it.
Why does that sound like baklava? That sounds like baklava to me. No just one would name their kid Marc Lefebvre.
Just pronounce it like you're a stupid American, but then add some French to the end of it. Just go, all right. Marc Lefebvre, croissant.
Tout à l'heure.
Bonjour, croissant, le bon fond.
Je voudrais un croissant, s'il vous plaît. All right, so Mark, big hugs coming out from me to you because I've now murdered your name. Here's Mark.
What's that frog's question?
Hey, come on. The U.S. and France are on a patch-up, so let's leave that out.
What's his freedom question?
His freedom fries question is, first want to just say, never mind, that's a compliment, and then we'll skip the question. Anyways, I want to start – oh, wait a minute. That was not the question I wanted to answer. Oh, God, that's embarrassing.
What a train wreck this episode is going
to
be.
The first question I wanted to start out with actually was from Sean McMillan. Mark,
oh, Sean Mark, McMillan.
Even bigger hugs going out to you, Mark.
Big
now.
Irish
anyway,
hugs.
All right, now we're going on to Sean McMillan. Right, so Sean writes in. He says, my question. Do you guys write on a daily basis, or do you write mini strips at one time? Do each of you write really far ahead on occasion? Basically, his question is, how does your man do it there? Right, do you want to go catch a film? Because I'd love to see that film, The Real Life of Dan in Real Life. Right. Oh, great. That'd be grand.
Wow. We're in trouble.
Now I'm just going off on Irishisms for 10 minutes.
We're in big
right,
trouble.
I'm 33 years old. How old are you lads? Right.
You just do that for 10 minutes and then you go, well, anyway, thanks for your question. All right.
Or in true Irish form, I answer a question with a question. Right, Sean, what kind of comic strip cartoonist are you now? Right, okay, grand.
Well, how is that any of your business? Next question.
Next question. All right, I spit on your mother's grave with a question like that. That's terrible. All right,
well,
go ahead. Bam.
What I like to do before eating some haggis when I'm writing storylines.
Haggis? Oh, you've insulted two nations now.
Oh, oops, I'm sorry. Wait, that's Scottish. What I like to do before drinking myself into a stupor. And picking a fight is I like to paint myself in a corner. And I don't know if the madness started before I can't remember if I planned this from the beginning or if it just started to work for me and I got stuck in it, but I tend to write the beginning of a storyline and then stop and just go. Like, I'll plot out all the way to the middle of it and then figure that I'll work the rest of it out as I go. Then what I always end up with is a situation where I'm in the middle of a storyline and I'm not 100% sure how I want it to end, and it's the panic of the deadline that forces me to work out that perfect inspiration and nail it. Now the pros of that are when I do force myself to make it click and it works, it is fantastic beyond where I could have plotted it out well in advance. But every once in a while, you trip and you end up with a storyline that, you know, is written because you're out of time. And it isn't until afterwards that you figure out what would have been the perfect thing to do, but you didn't catch it the first time around. So I really need to find a way to start writing ahead more and going from beginning to end. But painting myself in a corner and then having to work myself out has just been my method of choice for so long. It's hard to break out of the habit. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like to write a week at a time. I like to write in bunches, and I think that just kind of fits my comic because I do a more storyline-driven comic. So I'll usually sit down Monday and Tuesday will be my big writing days, and I'll try to write something that goes in six-day spurts. And if I get into a storyline that goes longer than that, what I usually do is kind of have an idea of a beginning and a middle of an end, and then I'll allow myself kind of almost – getting a little bit closer to Scott's way, I will allow myself the freedom to come up with those individual steps as I write on my Monday and Tuesday. So I don't have everything completely nailed down, but I do know where it's going. And then you find out, in the same vein of what Scott's saying, give yourself that chance for a little creativity in the middle. You just have to be careful. There's one thing that I found myself doing this, is that every step has to be, like we talked about in the past, a satisfactory update. It's got to be a satisfactory installation. So you know where you need to move the plot. And sometimes it's like you say to yourself, okay, well, this strip isn't going to be funny, but it's going to move the plot. And I think that you can't allow yourself that degree of complacency. Every strip has got to have something there. If it's not a punchline, it's a cliffhanger or something interesting there to keep that person that's coming to your strip for the first time that day to come back the next day.
Hmm. Yep, that's a good point. Well, Scott, it's funny because I had never codified it the way you just did, but I think actually I write both individual strips and longer storylines the way you just described, which is sort of start the process and see kind of where it takes you without forcing a control on the situation. And I got that from – I think I originally got that from Mort Chuckles Walker, who I read somewhere that he said that he used to write Beatles Bailey comic strips like that, where he literally would just have start with no intention where it was going to end. He would be like – who ate my pie? And then Beetle Bailey's got to respond and then take it from there. And I guess the idea behind that is that most of the humor that arises in life just arises from, you know, normal conversation. So why not just start off any normal conversation and see what it takes you or situation? And I don't know that if I make that a conscious choice, but it sort of has become the way I've fallen into writing, which is aside from a few cases where like I do these longer Saturday only storylines that sort of stretch out over months. And for those, like Brad said, I do try to have at least a beginning, a middle, or an end, or at least a sort of signposts along the way, if you know what I mean, mm-hmm. Of where I've got to get to. Like, well, I know it sooner or later here. I've got to get to XYZ. But not giving yourself a finish point or you know, a goal line that you've got to get to is actually kind of a natural way to respond to the way our business operates, which is that there are constant and incessant deadlines, and you can't forever prepare a storyline. You know, it's not the novel of your life that you're going to sit down and write a beginning, middle, and end for. It's a omnipresent thing that. So that's sort of I think a natural reaction in terms of writing style to that.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
But here's a follow up question to that that I think is an interesting follow up is when do you guys think, because our job is to write in these minuscule, almost haiku like little 10-second bursts every day, or you know, depending on how long you update every second day or whatever. But when does a storyline start to become too long? Is it 2 weeks? Is it 3 weeks? Is it 4 weeks? Is it a month? Is it Well, 4 weeks is also a month, so I should clarify that.
For me,
like, when do you guys start to feel like you're going long, basically?
I start to panic. Well, you know what? It really depends. It seems to me like on some storylines, I can be going 3 weeks and feel strong about it, and in another storyline, I'm 1 week in and I'm ready to bail. I mean, I guess it all depends on how much steam I feel that I have. But I have really found that if I go any more than a month, if I'm not winding down in that last fourth week, people start asking when I'm going to move on. You know, the readers the readers seem to want it. Now, that's not saying they're not enjoying the storyline, but to get it in one strip per day increments like that, and it's 24 hours between your next beat in the storyline, it's got to be really, really funny every day, regardless of the storyline, for them to maintain an interest beyond a month. I keep mine around 3 weeks.
I tend to agree. I think a month is good. I think I've done a few 5 week storylines, and I think they felt a little long. And looking back, I see where I could probably have trimmed them a little bit and made them better as an effect. But at the same time, you can also, I think it's very useful to think of your strip, if you're writing a storyline, in terms of what's going to happen over the course of the year. And that may be an arc that's built up of a number of smaller storylines, but don't shy away from really having that long view of where you're going, you know? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys experimented with the idea at all, or considered at all the idea of what sitcom writers do, where there's really two story arcs per arc that kind of intertwine? Like there's an A story and a B story?
That's what I was saying before, that that our writing style sort of naturally grows out of our deadlines, because I don't think we write for a form that works with an A and B story on a day-to-day basis. You know what I mean? If I was writing a 30-page comic book, maybe, yeah, but I don't know that it works on a day-to-day strip as much.
I think it'd be so hard to do that for a comic strip, you know, because you've already got these pauses in between your story as it is. But then when you'd have to pause story A to jump to story B, and I don't know. To be honest with you, Scott, I have thought about that, because I'd be watching reruns of Seinfeld, and I'd see how they'd have these two and sometimes three storylines all circling around, and then you know at the end that everything's going to get tied up into a neat little bundle, and you're just wondering how they're going to do it, you know. And I thought, geez, that'd be great to try and do for a comic strip, but I've never been able to figure out exactly how to do that.
I think what I'd like to try is rather than have the A story and B stories intertwine, is connect them. For example, right now what I'm doing is 1 week they're playing Halo, and then the last Halo strip ends, and the next strip begins, and it's like, hey guys, I just inherited a house from my uncle, but we only get it if we stay in it overnight, and it's haunted. You know, it's like... It's a real rough transition. You know, you go from Halo strips to a strip about a haunted house. And what are you doing? Are you whispering to Brad?
My wife just asked me when I was coming down for dinner. I'm sorry.
I'm sitting here talking. All of a sudden, you're going,
I didn't know you guys could hear that. I'm sorry.
Even better, it's like a snippet of Brad's marital life. I told you I don't want roast beef.
I'm doing a podcast.
I'm so sorry. I should have hit the mute button.
I
apologize.
I'm whispering. They can't hear me. I'm being quiet. Yeah, I'll have a drink. Okay.
Yeah, sure. I'd love another glass of wine.
Send the kids to the movies. I'll be done here in a half hour. Okay.
Hey, you know what, though? In all seriousness, this thought just occurred to me. If you're going to do an A and B story, why not take advantage of the malleability of the web and run your A story as one strip on top and your B story as one strip on the bottom for 2 weeks and see, and then tie them up together? That might be interesting.
That sounds like twice the work, Dave.
Man, that sounds like the same thought.
That sounds like 2 weeks worth of work for 1 week's worth of payoff, my friend.
I like how your immediate reaction is, that sounds suspiciously like effort, and I don't want that.
Whoa, easy, pal.
Hey, hold up there, champ.
Well, no, but
is
I
running for president?
No, I think there's something to be said for that attitude, though, because, you know, there's something Scott has said in the past, and that is, you know, you're going to be doing the strip every day for the rest of your, you know, professional life, or at least that's the goal. Yeah.
Let's pace ourselves, kids.
Yeah, you don't want to, you know, double your effort for nothing, you know?
That's true.
Well, like, for example, I mean, I think it'd be neat to blend them in. So you end up with a longer story arc because the two are connected. You have a week where they're playing Halo strips, and then the next week is about the fact that Skull has epileptic seizures when he plays video games. But they connected.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. It's just tough because you only have this attention span for these minuscule amounts of time every day.
Yeah.
So it's tricky. I mean, I don't – I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying I will commend you if you can pull it off, because I think it's hard, not on your part, but on readers' parts, to make that connection.
Well, you're kind of doing it with your Saturday storylines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, because in a way it's sort of like if you do it once a day or once a week, it's sort of like – you know what it is? It's like the disconnect of Sundays versus dailies, because so many people have gotten emotionally – used to that like, oh, the Sundays don't, because they had different deadlines traditionally in newspapers. People got used to the idea that the Sundays don't really follow the dailies as far as a storyline.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was sort of my philosophy with the Saturday only strips, is that they don't really have to follow the storyline of the strip. But maybe you're right, Scott. Maybe I haven't thought that.
We should have a bet. We should challenge ourselves to see who can have the longest storyline. You know?
Oh my God! You know what though? Can I put on a Brad Geiger hat for a minute, actually, and get stern?
Oh, okay.
Are you going to pull a gun on us?
No, but whenever I go into tirade mode, I like to pretend that I'm Brad now. So
I'm going to talk like Brad now. Listen. I told you I don't like mashed potatoes.
When you are doing a humor strip and it's a gag a day and there's fun characters and everybody's having a good time, and then suddenly you decide that in your heart of hearts, that strip needs to launch into a 2-year arc storyline where everybody's dying and there's all sorts of drama going on. There's nothing wrong as an artist with wanting to change gears, but you cannot get mad at your readership if they up and leave or if they up and complain, because there's an implied promise when you're first meeting them as a gag strip or as a joke a day strip. And then if you suddenly go into a 2-year story arc that's burning inside of you that you had to tell, there's nothing wrong with having to tell that story arc, but you cannot get mad at your readership for leaving you.
Right, so take that, Tom Battia.
I was just gonna say. Hey, look, why do they call peanuts peanuts when they're not peanuts at all? They're actually legumes. Anyway, I'm dying of AIDS.
No, you know what? And as much as I hate to have my curmudgeon status usurped by Dave in this, he's absolutely right. Although that doesn't mean that you can't have a moment or two of seriousness in your strip. But I think when you completely, like Dave said, throw that throttle all the way over and start, you know, completely changing the nature of your strip, you got to expect a certain amount of reader revolt, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
When you make it drastic.
What do I think of what?
Well, there's a difference between offering a touching moment or a poignant moment and just drastically changing gears. It's like going down the highway at 70 and then throwing it into reverse.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's why I'm not saying, Scott, that and I think all three of us would agree that actually having a poignant moment or really heartfelt or heart-tugging moment in a strip is actually one of those most powerful things you can do. What I'm saying is when you suddenly decide that your gag-a-day strip, because I've seen this happen and I won't name names, but they suddenly change gears and then it's a 2-year story arc where, oh, everybody's dying and everybody's crying and everybody, oh, look at all the character development. But in your mind, you're like, well, this is not the strip I signed up for. Right. And there's nothing wrong with the artist wanting to tell that story. God forbid I ever limit an artist from telling the story that they want to tell. I'm just saying you can't get mad at your audience if they start to push back on it because there was implied promise.
Like if you do really pop culture-y kind of humor and then all of a sudden you decide to launch into a 3-week murder mystery story arc, I mean, you should expect some blowback. I think. Is that what you're saying, Dave? Is that what you're saying?
That was not it. No, I can name strips, and you guys would know them immediately. But
all right,
you know what? Even if you want to just look at it from a Funky Winkerbean standpoint,
yeah, that's what I. That's immediately what came to mind over here.
But you know, there's another year of leading this ridiculous high school band. Oh, these kids! Anyway, I'm dying of cancer. My dog loves lasagna, which happens to be poisoned.
This will be the last time I see that leaf fall off the tree. You know, I think there's another way that you can satisfy that A story, B story craving too. And that, and I love doing this. When I used to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer on the TV, I would love
on the TV. Brad, you are the oldest man alive. When I listen to radio on the radio, I like to listen to PBS.
I was playing an adventure game on Babbage's Difference Engine, and
oh my god, a Difference Engine reference, nice.
So gather around the radio to listen to one of my stories.
I was when I need to use a perambulation to get into town, I use my perambulator.
And I was sitting around the small radiation box to watch my stories about a young Jewish woman who fights Draculas on the television.
Another Artie Lang callback. I love that.
My telephone is ringing.
Go ahead, Brad. Brad, tell us about this miracle televised fight. Go ahead.
Well, tell us more about these televisions of which you speak.
This telebroadcasted image, yes.
You know what I used to love about how Josh Whedon would write a script, and that was somebody that you'd see walking across the background scene in season one would come back in season five as a central character. And I think you can do a little bit of that and satisfy some of that A story, B story craving. In doing that, a lot of times I like going through some of my older strips and taking a look at some of those people that I just drew off the top of my head to fill out a background or maybe just appeared to deliver one punchline and then disappear, and then use them later as somebody who comes in as a central character. And it's really kind of a present to all the people that have been reading you forever, since the very beginning, or buying your books, because they get rewarded for hanging with you all this time. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. You know who else is really good at that is Joss Whedon.
No, but Joss Whedon is also very good, Brad.
Josh is also very talented.
On your televised picture box, I love Joss Whedon. He's great. Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite television writer right now?
Well, Dave... I have often picked up my phone and dialed Klondike 5612 to tell my father that my favorite television machine
operator
serial happens to be that gadfly Jack Benny.
When we're done with this podcast and then Brad goes and has dinner with the family, he can't wait to catch up on his stories from the picture box. That's going to be a good time.
When Mr. Benny and that Rochester tangle up, my goodness.
Rochester. All right. Let's go on to the next question, shall we?
Let's hit that.
And by the way, that last question was from Sean McMillan of grieforglory.com. I should start doing that more often. It's telling where people are
Sean
from.
McMillan, grief for glory.
Oh, lady. All right. So the next question is from Gregory King. Greg writes, a lot of compliments. Thank you, Greg. Okay. This is sort of an extension of our last question. Something I've never heard creators talk about much is how I do my comic discussions, which tend to focus on the drawing of the strip for a particular day. His question is, how do you write your long storylines? Is it enough to get a general idea in your head and go from there, or you do it day by day? Oh, I guess we already answered this, did we? Mm. Well, thank you for your question, Greg. I just covered that.
Well done.
Good job, Greg.
Where are we standing at time-wise right now?
We've done it for 24 minutes.
24. I tell you what, I can smell dinner downstairs, and I know you've got a 40-minute interview. Do you want to call this one, wrap it up a little
Did
bit?
Did your marital spouse prepare nutrients on your inside her convection machine?
Using the power of waves that can be measured only by a micrometer, she heats up food using the expansion of no, that's great.
Yes, Brad, let's totally wrap it up.
Well, Brad, let's wrap it up so that you can enjoy your protein suspensions.
That's right, because I'm starving over here.
Hey, Brandon, when you're done with them, if you could mail me back my Josh Whedon CDs, that'd be great, or DVDs, that'd be awesome.
And then, Brad, be sure after you've eaten your protein suspensions to sit ever so carefully on your porcelain depository and poop. just poop.
And on that beautiful visual.
Yeah, thank you for that follow-up.
It's my pleasure to tell you that you've been listening to Webcomics Weekly with your friends Scott Kurtz at pvponline.com, Dave Kellett at sheldoncomics.com, and me, I'm Brad Geiger at evil-comic.com.
And make sure you stay tuned for Scott's excellent interview with the guy from Hallmark.
Don't stop listening now, because we're going to connect you right now to a previously recorded interview with Brian R. Gordon and his pal Chris Harding. Brian works at Shoebox, a little division of Hallmark, and Craig works for Hallmark Online making e-cards. And we talked today for about 40 minutes. It was a great discussion, and they're just a bunch of great guys. Craig is actually branching out into webcomics, and so if you'd like to read along as you listen, head over to wetherobots.com, wetherobots.com. And here we go, our interview with Brian and Craig. Did I say that? No, Brian and Chris. Jeez.
Oh, Josh and Josh.
All right. Touche.
Hey, we'll Brian, see you later, guys.
Brian, Skip, it's been a great podcast. Thank
you. Bob, John. I'll see you guys later. You guys take off. I'm going to go interview Kyle and Janet over at Hallmark.
All right, guys.
All right. All right, we got a little pre-recorded interview here for this week's Webcomics Weekly. I'm Scott Kurtz, and with me today are some real cartoonists, professional cartoonists, not amateurs like me. I got both these guys work at Hallmark in different divisions. I have Brian Gordon, who works in the Shoebox division. And then I have Chris Harding, who works at Hallmark.com, and you make e-cards.
That's right.
So remind me, because our brains are so fried right now because we're working to get this How to Make Webcomics book out the door. You guys emailed us, right, because you're fans of the show?
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, as a matter of fact, another friend of ours, I think, initiated the whole thing, and then from there,
we got
involved. Yeah, Michael Buckley emailed you, I think, initially.
But now neither of you guys make webcomics.
No, I do. I just started one about a week and a half ago. I started doing it about a month ago, and it went public about a week ago.
What is the what's the name of your strip, and what's the URL so we can go find it?
It's called We the Robots. WeTheRobots.com, yeah. As in We the People, but with robots, I guess.
And I've got, we over in Shoebox are starting this little mom-and-pop kind of website thing. You'd think for a major bajillion-dollar corporation we'd have something bigger, but it's actually just a kind of little grassroots operation that we're doing, where we're a bunch of cartoonists and writers are just kind of doing our own thing. And so we've got our own little web comic, web funny, whatever thing, which is shoeboxblog.com. So.
Oh, nice. So you guys got to set up your own little blog of all the Shoebox guys.
Yeah, well, it's not so much like a web diary or anything like that. It's basically just... when you're doing, you know, cards and that sort of thing, you have to, like, okay, this is for Mother's Day, this is from, you know, aunt to mother to whatever, and it just kind of constricts you, and there's a lot of, you know, you have to really think about, okay, this is from this person to that person, whatever, whereas this is just kind of, okay, we're just trying to be funny, and people just kind of, you know, be able to do what they want to do, and so it's not too unlike what we do from day to day on cards or whatever, but it's just kind of, you know, not, it doesn't have to be for a purpose. It's not like product driven, like what we usually do. So it's kind of, and there's not a lot of screening and whatever. So if it's like what I do now, if I write something, it goes through a lot of editors and whatever, that sort of thing. Whereas for the blog, it's like, I think this is funny, and I draw it and I post it, and, you know, it kind of fails or, you know, succeeds.
So this
on
is
its own
this
merit.
Is kind of the Shoebox guys uncensored in a way. Or unedited, at least.
Exactly, yes.
Exactly. Now, do you find the editorial process is a little stifling at Shoebox, or is it? I mean, obviously, you've got to make cards that go into Walmarts and the Hallmark stores.
Yeah,
so,
it's not that bad. I mean, I've been here for about 10 years now, and when I first came in, I was young punk, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna set this company on the butt," and I just kidding, had a big attitude. But then after a while, I kind of got used to it and realized that the people in charge kind of knew what they were doing, more or less. The editors, had a pretty good eye for it. And there's been some cards that, were, about half of what I do is written by other people and half of what I do is stuff I write. And there's stuff where I'm like, I am going to rock the world with this greeting card. Everyone's going to think I'm hilarious and whatever, and for whatever reason I make it. And it just fails, it just bombs horribly. And there's other stuff that's come through where I'm like, this is the worst piece of crap ever, and no one's ever going to get it, and I don't get it, and whatever, but I guess, they're paying me, so I'll do it. And it's just a huge hit in itself. Millions and millions of cards over it. I think it's hilarious, so
there's probably what you have to do kind of here is learn. I think, I remember you guys mentioning a while back, like, that, people are kind of well-rounded. You just kind of learn to use the material that's a little, you kind of maybe over the course of time come up with a lot of ideas, and some of them are darker and some of them are very, sweet. And you just learn to only, that at this job you use the sweet ideas, because it really is about one person telling another person they were thinking about them. So you want to be, so it isn't as though there is an oppressive editing system. It's just that, these are the ideas that people are going to want to buy for this venue.
Yeah.
You use those here. And then, a lot of us will have outlets for other types of work that we want to do, like webcomics or whatever. Brian's written a screenplay. People go out, go out and kind of get that other stuff out other ways. And you just kind of know not to use it here. So it is not oppressive or anything. It's just you're just aiming for a certain feel.
You've got a target audience that you're. It's not that you're beholden to them, but it's the right tool for the right job. So
exactly, yeah. And
syndicated cartoonists they come across the same problems. Trying to make their strips work for family papers.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I used to do a strip in the late 90s, and I struggled with it. it was for that reason. That was part of it.
I used to have a much different attitude about that stuff, where it was, if you were making a strip for the newspapers, if you were making a family-friendly strip, that was bad. You had given up, and you'd sold out, and you were pandering to the masses, and my attitude recently has really changed about that. I mean, if I'm going to be fair, then a love or appreciation for the edgy stuff is a love and appreciation for the family friendly stuff is just as valid as appreciation for the edgy stuff. I think what happens is when you first start out as a kid, you do the stuff that pleases your parents, and then as you get older, you tend to get more sophisticated in the humor that you like, and so you try to, if you're a creative person, you try to graduate with your writing into that situation. And then once you've done that, it almost feels like you're heading backwards if you go back to the stuff that you started with. But it really isn't. It's really a lateral move.
I think you can begin to appreciate. I mean, I think the test for me has become whether something is true. Or whether you, and Lord knows, probably all of us have done something that's not true for a job, like pandering. But if you can find that thing that really is true, like that's also sweet about you, and use it, then it's still kind of coming from an honest place, and it's not, it's not garbage, But
yeah.
There is also a certain amount of, there are times when you say, I just need to get something sweet here, and you fake it. And maybe that's creatively less satisfying. But there is a side to everyone that they can, that isn't dishonest, that they can use for sweeter type of material.
I think that's important. So So let me ask you guys, because I know that you guys have some new projects and stuff that you want to talk about, but I really would be remiss not to ask. Because, you know, even as a guy who has a daily webcomic with some established revenue streams, I would not mind doing freelance work on the side, especially if it brought in some money. How difficult is it breaking into the business of greeting cards? How difficult is it landing that job at Hallmark?
I think some people have had very long journeys to get into it, and others. I mean, I just kind of got hired. They came to my school. I was at the University of Arizona, majoring in illustration. They came recruiting. The company will go out recruiting Hallmark, and I just got recruited. So for me, it just kind of fell into my lap.
Yeah.
But I know other people have come here and worked answering phones and whatever that took to be here for a while because they really wanted to do this. And, you know, then they try to find out who they need to talk to, and they'll try to show work and stuff like that, you know. And it. But there's a lot of work in greeting cards right now. I mean, there's a lot of – I mean, not to – I don't know. I don't want to undermine anything that we're doing, but there's a lot of companies out there doing it now. Printing has become quite a bit cheaper and easier, and there's a lot of boutique companies. There's a lot of work in this industry, I think.
What you're saying is, don't just assume that Hallmark's your only avenue.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Hallmark is certainly the biggest game in town. You know, we're the hugest company, but there's a jillion, you know, card companies out there doing stuff, and you know, some are doing better than others. You know, it's there's a lot of really crappy cartoons out there. There's, you know, and there's a lot of you know, just people stealing from other people. It's, you know, it's weird once you get into the business. You know, all the, you know, you see, like, you know, I won't name names, but you can see, like, oh, this company, you know, like, totally ripped off, you know, this artist that we have, or, you know, whatever. And there's all sorts of weird kind of crossover, you know, like that sort of thing. But as far as Hallmark goes, I mean, we're, you know, it's kind of hard to get in here. And being that we're, you know, again, the biggest game in town, it's, I think we get a lot of attraction, a lot of submissions and stuff like that. So it can be kind of hard. I got in myself by an internship.
Get in right out of school too, didn't you?
Yeah, I did an internship here, which was really hard. I came out for 3 months and with with like 10 other kids, and it was just like some sort of horrible real world experience. It was like being on a job interview for about 3 months, and it was just like, okay, this week we're all going to paint flowers, and you know, and it was sort of thing where it was kind of half art camp and half job interview, where it was like, you know, we were having fun, we're painting flowers, yay! And then at the end of the week, like, but you can't paint flowers, can you, Brian? I'm like, no. Mm-hmm.
It
you know,
it is a long process. It took, even though, like I say, I got like they came to my school. It took still, I think, 10 months. Before I actually started my job, it was a 10-month, like, many people had to look at everything, and it's, oh man, it really does take a while.
But
I don't think like that anymore.
The one thing that I had over maybe some of the other people in there, which I think, you know, a lot of cartoonists might have, is, you know, if you go in thinking, you know, if you want to try and do work for Hallmark, if you want to work for Hallmark, you know, like, oh, well, you know, I can't paint flowers, and, you know, I don't do those, you know, horrible watercolor paintings of lighthouses or whatever. Well, I don't do those either. And, you know, if they said, okay, but we need a really awesome painting of a lighthouse, I'd be, well, I'll get my stuff and go. But the one thing that I brought was, I'm like, okay, I do a lot of writing, and, you know, I, you know, hopefully some of my stuff's kind of funny, and they could, you know, that was how I sold myself versus, like, look how well I can render the living bejesus out of a daisy or something in a painting, so.
That would, like, if that would translate to somebody listening who's, like, maybe they're in school and they're thinking about it, just the thing is to not try to be something other than what you are. Just have a well-rounded portfolio, I think, and don't make a portfolio full of greeting cards because it's a really peculiar form of kind of cartooning that you're probably, you know, don't try to show that you're good at greeting cards because you're probably not going to, you know, just have good drawings, you know, figure drawing, anything, you know, whatever you're doing, they kind of know what they're looking for and they can use as a raw material to train you up, but it's like anything else. Just be solid, you know?
That's very interesting because, you know, that's almost the opposite of what I thought it was. I mean, maybe I'm just attracted to, as a cartoonist, I'm attracted to the cards that are cartoony, but it seems like, especially with Shoebox, it's almost like syndicated comic strips only on cards. Like, there's definite, not stars, but there's, you know, there's... It's almost like editorial cartoonists. You know, you can pick out their styles. You know which ones did which cards.
Right.
Sometimes there's even reoccurring characters in the cards.
That's right.
Or spokes characters.
Yeah. I can't think of that. Maxine. That's
the most famous one. You know, it'd be the old lady who tells it like it is. And, you know, we've had a number of other ones. There was, gosh, we had the guru guy. It was this guy sitting on a mountain. We had... the Greys, which were these aliens. They had Broderick, which was a coffee house character.
I remember Broderick, those,
yeah, and most of those guys have, or most of those characters have kind of fallen by the wayside, you know, for this reason or that. They just kind of discontinued them, and the only one that's really still going is Maxine, but she's not even the artist who does that, and the writers who do that are actually outside of Shoebox. It's kind of its own entity within Hallmark now, but...
They have their own comic strip too. They syndicated that.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, Broderick character was a huge inspiration for the character of Brent. My character Brent.
Oh, yeah. I can see. I can see the. Is that right? We'll have to tell Peter that.
Yeah. Oh, you know the guy. It's really funny because
it's a small group. Yeah.
It's funny because I was at the time I was creating PvP. I was a huge fan of the website suck.com. And and the work of Terry Colon. He was a huge influence on my cartooning, trying to get that flat kind of 2D style. And I had, at the time the strip was about it wasn't about video games or a magazine. It was about elementary school teachers. And Brent was the art teacher. And I was I was buying a gift for my wife at the Hallmark store for an anniversary or birthday or something. Doing that last minute, I'm just going to pace the Hallmark store until something seems thoughtful. And I was looking at the cards, and I saw that Broderick character, and I thought, this is what I want my art teacher to be like. I want him to be a real pretentious kind of coffee house guy that's stuck teaching these kids, you know. And that's where Brent kind of
that's pretty great.
Grew from.
I wonder if that character, because I don't think that character did gangbusters, although I think it did okay. I wonder if it was appealing to a little bit younger crowd than is typically wandering around the Hallmark store or something.
You're probably right.
It's one of the things that all of us are trying to work on is getting a little bit more, a little broader, younger audience. But as with newspaper comics, as you guys have mentioned a lot of times, it's just, they're not in the stores. And, you know, I'm afraid to. I mean, I work here. I'm sometimes afraid to go in some Hallmark stores. It seems like I'll break something, or you know, I don't know.
Yeah,
but then there are other ones that are nice that are redesigned lately. But
you're trying to skew young, and you're selling these cards in a store for is usually populated by 50 and up. Is what you're saying?
More or less that's true. And then you have things like Broderick. Which probably could succeed in certain places that are really good characters, and you wish you could reach the audience that you want with that character, and it's not always the audience you're handed in a Hallmark store at the mall. That's true.
It's just a fine line of trying to, like, you know, succeed with the people that are there and trying to reach a new audience with a new character. It's sort of thing where, like, okay, we're going to do Broderick, and he's going to appeal to the hip 20-somethings. And then you have a bunch of, you know, middle-aged women coming in and going, that's cute. Where's the old lady who tells it like it is whenever she wanders off to find the next thing card?
Yeah, you can't alienate the core group by filling the store with Broderick, because then you might bring the whole thing down. But
well, who primarily buys greeting cards, though?
It's
women.
The majority of them are women. And they, I don't know what the age group is. It's like 30 to, you know, and up is the biggest core audience.
My wife stockpiles them. She literally buys them ahead of time.
God bless her heart. Yeah, that's it's typically women. I think I would say at least 3/4 of our consumers are women. They tend to be older, you know, at least, you know, in their 30s typically. I mean, they're doing everything they can to try and broaden the range of who gets in there. And, you know, they're trying to, of course, you just like, if you're only selling to people who are, you know, our core consumers, like, you know, the older women or whatever, I mean, you know, they're not going to be around forever. So you have to perpetuate the business, you have to appeal to, you know, the younger crowd. So, you know, they're coming in and growing up and buying cards and, you know, hopefully enjoying what you're doing. You know, so you're just like, you know, trying to appeal to the same people forever. I mean, they're not going to be around forever. So,
yeah,
there's, you know, it's kind of
it really is similar to the newspaper dilemma that newspaper cartoonists or newspapers, not just the cartoonists, but newspapers in general kind of face, which is what's kind of, I mean, it's kind of exciting about webcomics. I mean, what's going on with webcomics and what's going on even, I guess, in parallel with e-cards online is maybe an equivalent thing.
Tell me about that. Tell me about the e-card business. I mean, is it booming? Is it big?
It's no. Well, it hit its peak, I think, around 1999 or 2000. And it's, I think we've gotten back up to about the level it was then. You know, there was kind of a big web bubble burst, and a lot of things kind of went south at that time, and things seemed less certain on the web. And the business model is something that everyone's still, I think, working out, because there's advertising. It's really even a little bit like webcomics in that way. There's ways you can make money with advertising or selling actual products. We have a set of characters that one of the guys in Hallmark.com made called Hoops and Yo-Yo. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. But
yeah,
they're in the e-cards.
The
they're a little green bunny and red, pink cat.
Pink cat, little green bunny.
They're actually doing a very good business on selling actual real-world products in Europe and, you know, and Europe, Asia, and in the United States now, too. So they'll make these e-cards for free. This has been the model in the past. They'll make the e-cards for free and just constantly, you know, come out with a couple a week or whatever. People come watch them and they kind of like the characters and they go buy something in
the
shop.
These are animated.
Yeah. Yeah. They are animated. And so, you know, they're kind of different from greeting cards in that way. Like they're a lot more labor intensive and they're complicated, but that's been one of the business models. Those characters have kind of broken out and now they're making quite a bit of money. But mostly through selling the products. Although Hallmark.com has recently switched over to a paying model that some of the e-cards you have to pay for, and they're working that out. I'm not sure where that's going to land, but it's primarily in the past been a way to drive traffic to the website in hopes of getting people to buy other things like flowers and
right
or even ad revenue that they've just started this year putting ads on the site. So it's something that it is being worked out by all the people doing e-cards still, how you make money at it. But it used to be a marketing tool. Like they used to think of us as a part of their advertising or marketing budget. You just go and make your little e-cards, and as long as you keep the traffic flowing, you're doing your job.
Right. Wow.
But now they're thinking of it more like a product, and that's a new game for us to figure out.
I really like the art style you guys are using on these e-cards. That kind of paper cut, gradients.
Yeah, it's flash. You know, it's all flash. So some of the challenge of that. I mean, I don't know if you're like a big flash user or whatever, but
Chris certainly is.
The look of flash can tend to look like flash. Like sometimes you find yourself fighting to make. You don't want the first thing that pops into people's head when they're watching something to be flash. You want them to think. You want them to be engaged in the story.
Yeah. Well, but I think a lot of stuff is kind of going in that direction now. You've got pretty much everything on the Cartoon Network has got that kind of flashy look. That's just kind of the.
Yep.
That's kind of become accepted as the new style.
It has. Yes, it has. But it's still, you still have to, the good ones, the good stuff, even on Cartoon Network, or it still has a look that I think goes a little bit beyond just what the software does by default. Like if you don't try really hard to kind of make a nice design, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what I'm saying.
I'm looking at this one E card right now with the polar bear troubadour.
What's that now?
I'm looking at this one E card right now with the polar bear troubadour. And
oh yeah, yeah, I made that one.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
That's a really nice card, but it's because the design of it is really slick.
It's well, thank you. It's yeah, I did that one a couple of weeks ago. It's yeah, it's an interesting.
You can pat yourself on your back. Don't be afraid.
The backgrounds were done in Photoshop on that one, I guess. And then the characters are Flash. But yeah, anyway, it's a really interesting business. I've done like quite a bit of animation over the years, just in e-cards, and learned quite a bit about it.
How long did it take you to put that e-card out, the Troubadour?
Usually you do these in like a week.
And did you do the voices? Is that you doing the voices, or did you hire a professional?
On that particular one, it's not. We have a guy, actually he's a writer in Shoebox, he wrote the song and recorded, well, he actually, as a matter of fact, he didn't do the voice because he's doing a voice of another character and they didn't want to confuse. But he played the guitar and wrote that song, and then another guy recorded the voice, and then another guy did the voice of the other character. And it's been very piecemeal here. Like it's getting more elaborate, but it'd just be like, all right, we would just record, you know, I mean, basically you write, you record, you mix the sound, animate, design, all of it. One person does all that.
Yeah, and you know what? This is not something that is impossible for a web cartoonist to do and put on his site as well. This is Flash and a microphone. We did those Blamimations. I don't know if you ever saw the...
Yes, I have.
Yeah, those Blamimations. Yeah. You could easily just reformat that so that it's a card. And probably with a little bit of freaks coding that you could find online, you could find a system by which people could email those to friends.
Yeah, you probably very well could, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's... I think a lot of people have done different things like that in the past where they'll have stuff you can email a little bit like an e-card or a postcard.
And what a great way to promote your strip as well.
Yeah, I have a little animated, a couple of little 30-second animated things with the characters can really bring them to life, I imagine.
Yeah. So, so what else, guys? What's
what else should we talk about?
What's
I have a tip. Hey, can I have a tip?
Yes.
Can I give a tip?
You have a pro
tip? I got a tip. Because I've been listening to the thing, and I've dug all these tips, and I thought of one.
I'll put a stinger in right here.
Okay.
Okay, go.
Okay, my tip is I used to draw on paper, even like, and Brian still draws like with a crow quill and stuff. I used to do that, but in learning how to draw digitally on the computer for speed and also to be able to work in Flash, I had to start using a Wacom tablet, which I was very uncomfortable with, and a lot of people probably are. It's hard to draw on them. I don't know. Do you draw on paper? Yeah.
I would say about this time last year, I switched over to the Wacom, and I do all my inking digitally.
That's awesome.
And
it looks great. Well, anyway, my tip is when you're getting started, if it feels crappy, like drawing on that plastic thing, is that you tape a piece of like tracing paper or vellum over the Wacom tablet, and it feels like more like you're drawing on paper. It has that tooth to it. It has that friction.
Oh.
That you're used to drawing on paper, and it doesn't affect the tablet's function if the paper is not too thick. And somebody gave me that tip when I was first starting to try to use it, and it made a huge difference for me.
Wow, tried that. I know I've heard that you can buy specialty tips that go into the pens that have more of a feel.
Oh, like, really?
Yeah, that where the grip, that tooth, that friction you're looking for, they put in the actual tip of the
that's
pen.
That's awesome. Well, here's a shortcut that's as cheap as a piece of paper.
Exactly. Or buy a piece of paper.
Oh.
What did you say?
Brian said, or buy a piece of paper. Yeah, well,
yeah.
Brian, what we're trying to do here is
find yourself a piece of paper.
Whatever works for you, but anyway.
See, what I'd like to do is, and I think they do this, you take a piece of paper, you tape it down to the Wacom, and then you get a special tip for your pen that's actual graphite. And then,
yeah.
And then as you draw, awesome. You're actually drawing it on the paper. And,
that would be the greatest.
But you're inking digitally on the screen, so even though you did everything digitally, you still have an original to sell.
You still have an original to sell. Absolutely. Brilliant. Absolutely.
That's my pro tip.
The thing is, speaking of that, it does wear your tip out. I have to replace the Wacom tips more often because of this drag on the paper. It actually grinds them down like a pencil lead. It takes a long time, but there's a little warning about that.
Little pro tip warning. To accompany your pro tip. So now I take it that at least one of you or both of you live over in Kansas City, Missouri, over where Hallmark is?
Yeah, a little suburb in Kansas.
Oh, we actually both – Kansas City straddles Kansas and Missouri, and most people – well, we used to live in Missouri – I mean, I live like a mile from the state line. I cross it every morning. You know, it's like weird. You're in two states, and you have to pay taxes in both states. It's a real chore. But,
I have a friend that lives there, lives over by the what is the name of that shopping center with the Apple store and the Macy's and the fountain?
The Plaza.
Yeah, the Plaza there.
Yeah, lives right over by the Plaza.
And that's in Missouri, probably. And, once you get to the age, like I've got two young children, Brian's got one on the way, and this, you don't want to go to school in Missouri if you can help it.
The schools in Kansas are better?
Because I don't know why, the downtown, like downtown Kansas City is kind of a ghost town. They're working to bring it back, but it's kind of a wretched place. And there's no money in the schools. I think the Missouri school, Kansas City, Missouri school system lost their national accreditation a few years ago. You just don't want to go to school there if you can help it.
I'll have to ask my friend.
And
the
Johnson County, Kansas, right on the border here of Missouri here, is actually a very well-off school district. You got to steer the kids clear of whatever weird things they might teach them that you... You don't agree with
the so-called evolution, then, you know, maybe Kansas isn't for you, but,
that's been overhyped. Or maybe it hasn't, I don't know, my kids are not of school age yet, but I just know that at least there's a budget for a school in Kansas, so, like, they have a roof and things like that. So anyway, we live in Kansas, but working.
I'm typing to my friend Aaron Williams. He does a comic strip called Nodwick, and does a comic book called PS238. He lives over there by the Plaza, and I'm telling him that I'm talking to you guys, and that the schools in Missouri are bad. And he goes, "Very likely, very likely."
Yeah.
So there's another pro tip: if you're going to live in the Kansas City area, make sure you're on the Kansas side if you have kids.
Once you have kids, a lot of people tend to move over.
Mad about that. There's a crazy Missouri-Kansas rivalry here, too. So it's probably, when this gets aired, there'll be people in Missouri side with burning torches like coming to our...
I was not aware of this rivalry. So I just, opened my mouth. Now, people are going to burn my house down. Oh, well.
Oh, that's fine. If I just read out loud what Aaron just typed to me, I think that... He says he'd rather live in Missouri and use private schools than go to Kansas and live in white Flightia.
Oh, man. Exactly. Yeah, I hear it. I hear that. I lived downtown for 6 years. I haven't been out in the suburbs very long. Yeah, he's right. He's got us there.
Yeah. Well, so guys, listen, we'd love to talk to you more, and we're trying to start a new podcast kind of in the evenings called Webcomics Weekly Live, where
yes, I read about that,
where we do kind of an open panel where other cartoonists and professionals call in, and we all just have a group discussion, kind of improv on the fly. We did one last night; it went okay. I think it's going to take a while to ramp up, but. Once we nail down a regular schedule for that, I'll let you know about it, because I'd love for you guys to be on it.
Yeah, anytime. Just let us know if there's a, you know, there's a slot to fill, airtime to fill.
Well, listen, it was great talking to you guys. You really surprised me. I would have thought that if you were going to submit to Hallmark, that you would really want to kind of put together a whole package of greeting cards or any greeting card company. But
it may be the case that other places they want that. At Hallmark, I think they'd rather just see that you're solid in many ways and maybe a little versatile, but or in Brian's, in my case, both of us were also writers. So
I did want to ask one more question before I let you go. What's the working environment like? So is it a big bullpen? Is it a bunch of creative bouncing off of each other? Do you guys kind of live separate creative lives at Hallmark?
A lot of separate creative lives, especially with the humor artists. It's not an easy thing to collaborate on humor. You know, although there are writers and artists, there are some people that just draw, some people that just write, and there's a little mix of weird people that do both. Especially in Shoebox, there's quite a few of those. But it's a lot of cubicles, and most of the time you're just sitting there doing your thing. Excuse me.
It is a good environment, though. I mean, it's different. I mean, it's definitely your corporate environment. I mean, you know, you get your beige cubicles and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's a really laid-back kind of groovy environment, too, in its own little extent. Because, I mean, you know, you come to work and, you know, shorts and your concert T-shirt and whatever, and it's just a lot of people just kind of hanging out and drawing and writing and whatever. And it's cool to be able to – that's, like, one of my favorite things about the job is that I can – you know, poke my head over the wall and go, hey, does this joke make any sense? And, you know, talk to somebody who knows and, you know, who, you know, will have a good input, or, you know, I can show them a drawing or whatever. So it's kind of a cool little community like that that, you know, you wouldn't get if you're, you know, sitting in your basement or in your studio or whatever by yourself and you have like one or two friends that you can talk to. But it's just kind of cool being surrounded by like some ridiculously talented people.
You wouldn't believe that the talent. You can walk around and just have your head blown off by how good people are at this here, and that's real beneficial. But you know, it is. It's very relaxed. People work. People mostly keep quiet and work, but you can walk around any minute of the day and just be inspired by what people are drawing.
Let's talk real quick about creator rights. Now, I'm working at Hallmark. I'm working in the e-card division, and I come up with a little pink cat and a green bunny named Hoops and Yo-Yo, and it takes off. Pretty soon, Hallmark's got it on greeting cards and mugs, and it becomes an animated series. I'm still getting paid the same wage this week as I did last week, right?
That's right. If something like that happens, you're likely to get a significant bump. The guy that created Hoops and Yo-Yo, Bob Holt, told a joke at a we were actually at a cartoonist little convention, local chapter convention the other day, and he said that he got new windows for his house out of the deal. But you still are on salary. Everything is work for hire here, so you don't own any of the things you do.
But maybe if you become well known enough, like Bob over there with Hoops and Yo-Yo, you know, and his name gets associated with it somehow. Maybe he could parlay that into some other successful creator-owned things.
That could be. Although right now he's buried under a huge amount of work on Hoops and Yo-Yo because it's been successful. But I think that the guy that does Maxine, I think they've all been. It's not like they just say thank you very much, go back to your desk. I think they.
They're compensated.
I think they're compensated, but I have actually no idea how or what the terms of that are. But you don't own it, no. You don't have control over it.
And the upside to that, of course, is like, you know, that's what a lot of people say. It's like, oh, so you don't own this, so if it does awesome, then you don't get anything. You know, like I wrote a card a while ago that was like one of the top-selling cards of all time for Shoebox, and I got like a $50 gift certificate to Amazon. They're like, yay, here you go. You made the company $1 billion.
But at the same time, I can write 500, well, maybe if I got up to 500, they'd can me, but I could write a bunch of cards that tank, but I still get paid. So there's an upside.
Yeah, exactly. That's the upside. Is, you know,
I'm not taking the risk.
Pictures I've written.
Brian,
never,
what was
know,
the card?
Like,
what was the card you wrote?
It was, we do these things, and it's kind of, and they were photo card brainstorms you do, and it's kind of like when you see in the magazine, it's like, write a funny caption for this.
Yeah.
It basically, we do that where they'll like find a pile of photos, and then they'll put one up and like, okay, everybody, write something, you know, to this for the next 5 minutes, go. And so we're all just going to sit around and write whatever. And 90% of it is just absolute obscene, you know, ridiculously unprintable stuff, you know, because we're just trying to crack each other up. And then every once in a while, like, one will leak out that'll be, you know, like, wow, that could actually be printed on paper and sold to the general public. And the one I did was just, it was like a stupid joke about it was like a fat guy golfing on the beach in a Speedo and a little visor. And basically, it's such a non-joke. And it was basically, I wrote a little word, a little thought balloon above it, said, like, I hope this visor doesn't make me look fat, ha ha ha, whatever. And it was just like a little stupid, like, wasn't brilliant, wasn't anything, you know, like, well, I did several drafts to get the fat guy joke right, whatever. It just kind of like, whatever. And they're like, oh, it's cool. They printed it, and it sold ridiculous. It was like just bajillions and bajillions of cards of these just sold for whatever reason. You know, the general populace loves a guy in a Speedo golfing on the beach, whatever. And it just blew out. And so that was a huge success, probably, as stupid as it was, just me drawing a word balloon on a, you know, an existing photograph. Whereas, you know, God knows I've done, you know, just a ton of cards, which just tanked. And, you know, at the end of the day, I still get, you know, like, I can still pay my mortgage and have health insurance and that sort of thing. So yeah, it evens out. And so
work for hire is not, work for hire is not evil. It's not the enemy.
You have to just, I mean, you agree to it coming here. So it's not as if it were thrust upon you. You just have to say, okay, you know, if you don't want to do it, then
no,
I wouldn't recommend.
I understand
but it's,
that.
It's not evil. It's just one way of doing things. You know, like I say, a lot of us try to keep kind of an outlet on the side. You know, a lot of people do fine art, or they do all kinds of things on the side to kind of keep ownership of something, because it's kind of somehow seems to be important to people. It is to me, to have something going that I can own and control, because you certainly don't necessarily control everything that goes on in a corporation. But it's not evil. It's just it's one way of doing business, and if you're okay with it, it's pretty cool because you get health insurance.
Yeah,
I mean, there's some people that are doing this, and you know, who are trying to make a living in art, and for their 9 to 5, you know, they're folding T-shirts at the Gap or, you know, flipping burgers or whatever, and you know, that's all fine and good, and you know, you got to do what you have to do, but at least, you know, this way, it's like, well, you know, if I can, you know, make art and, you know, support myself. And, you know, sometimes, you know, God knows there's cards I've done or projects I've been involved in or whatever that I haven't been, you know, that passionate about or isn't what I necessarily would have done. That's completely up to me, but, you know, it's, you know, I'm drawing, I'm writing, I'm whatever, I'm still using, you know, my skills that, you know, that I have versus, like, you know, digging a ditch or, you know, doing something horrible to have to support, you know, other things I might have going on. So,
Hallmark, better than digging ditches.
that's
the recruiting slogan.
Yeah.
Well, listen, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you guys on here. I really do want to show that work for hire, when it's up front and is understood, is not a bad thing. I have a lot of friends who work for Marvel and DC. They draw and write for intellectual property that's been owned and developed by another company for the last 40 years, and they love it. They make good money. They have a good time. And it bolsters their marketability when they do their own creator owned stuff. It's not the enemy. The problem is when people try to cloak work for hire in the very creator friendly sheep's clothing that upsets me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, any kind of deceptiveness like that is poison.
So it's good to talk to guys like you that really feel creatively fulfilled and have a good time at your jobs, and are doing work for hire stuff, because you know, the work for hire creative stuff is a good deal. And I'm glad you guys get to do it.
Yeah, we are too. Thank God,
you know, full time cartoon.
No, yeah, I just think. Yeah, it's a rare thing to make a living drawing cartoons.
Yeah, it's certainly a difficult path, but if you can get the work, man, it's go for it. It is a great work for hire. Cartoon work is great, a great way to go.
It can be. It's really, you know, if the individual's up for it, it really can be.
Well, listen, guys, we're right at about 42 minutes. I'm going to stop the recording, and we're going to...
Well, thank you for having us.
We're going to tack this on to today's Webcomic Weekly. It should be up a little bit later tonight. So, once again, for everyone listening, this has been Brian and Chris, Brian Gordon and Chris Harding. Did I get that right?
That's right. Yes, you did.
And you can see their work at shoeboxblog.com and also at wetherobots.com. And Chris, there's also a link on We the Robots to some of your animation work that I've just been looking at.
That's right.
Everyone be sure to check that out, too.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for having us, Scott.
No problem.
Thanks so much.